this is the last lecture, so we'll...
Even more difficult because it's in a year's time. So.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's see if there's more people coming in at 11. Okay, so so this will be the final lecture in this course, and today I'm actually going to prove a uniqueness result in the inverse program. Okay, and so I'm actually going to take a slightly different point of view as compared to the lecture notes, and I'm also going to tell you, explain to you one part from an upcoming paper with Dos Santos, Kurulev, Lassos, and myself. Okay, so let me just still remind you once more about the question we are looking at. So MG is a compact manifold boundary. And the idea is to show that if you have two potentials, let's say they are smooth functions in M, they could be L infinity, but you could even assume that they are nice and smooth. So then the idea is to show that the potentials would be the same. Okay, and so we've, as we've seen many times, so this has been reduced to proving the density of products of solutions, and going to showing that. Okay, and I'm going to make a small change to what I did below. I'm going to put the bar here. So that if you have two solutions, U1 and U2, of the corresponding Schrodinger equations, that then I want to show that this set is dense in L1, or maybe even in some weaker sense. Well, of course, if the V is real valued, then if U is a solution, then U bar is a solution. So I haven't really changed anything. Okay, so far. So I'm trying to go to proving this kind of density result. So I invested a lot of energy in Karlemann estimates, which is somehow a way of somehow converting nice approximate solutions to these equations into exact ones in such a way that you have some asymptotic limit, and then in the limit somehow the error terms will go away, so you can just use your nice approximate solutions. So we'll be using a limiting Karlemann weight to do this. And recall that we've seen that, so we made a fairly detailed analysis of this limiting Karlemann weight condition, at least the kind of condition which stayed. And so this basically means that locally your manifold is embedded in a cylinder. When the cylinder is so there might be a conformal factor, but for simplicity I'm going to forget the conformal factor here, and also I'm going to assume this this form globally. Mm. So the picture again is in the following. So you have x1 direction, which is Euclidean, and then you have some transversal manifold m0, g0, and then you assume that the original domain is embedded in this cylinder. So m0, g0 is going to be n minus 1 dimensional, and compact Riemannian manifold with boundary. And dimension bigger than equal to 3. Okay, so I'm going to be working in this setting, and I'm going to try to prove the density result. Okay, so I will do this by constructing special complex geometrical optic solutions to the Schrödinger equation. So this is really what all of these earlier lectures have been aiming at. So you will have U1, which is okay. So let me just say that my limiting Karnaugh weight in this picture will be x1. So this is the natural limiting Karnaugh weight in the cylinder. So U1 would be, and now I'm going to again. I'm not going to use symbol calculus. I'm going to use large parameter tau. And the idea is that if you choose these complex amplitudes m1 and m2 in a good way, so then your correction terms will be going to zero when tau goes to infinity. So if you can arrange this to happen, so then u1, u2 bar will look like m1, m2 bar for tau large. Okay, so somehow you are the products of the amplitudes are the thing which are going to give you the density. Okay, so now in this picture somehow you can think of the different variables separately. So you can think of x1 somehow as independently, and then the x prime variables, which are the variables m0, somehow separately. And you could try to produce a dense set of functions in x1 and then a dense set of functions in x prime somehow separately. So let me modify this construction just a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to, instead of taking a large real parameter tau, I'm going to take a slightly complex frequency. And so I'm splitting my variables as x1, which is the Euclidean variable, and x prime, which is the variable in m0. And I'm going to make the assumption that the amplitude now only depends on the x prime. And I'm going to make a similar thing for u2. So where S is going to be written as tau plus I lambda. Lambda is a fixed real number. So it is somehow, in the end, tau is going to infinity, but lambda will be fixed. So this will be a kind of slightly complex frequency. And The idea is if you make this this convention. Huh, nice. Easter. I wonder if there's more hidden somewhere. Okay, so any, yeah. I can hide a few more for you. Okay, so anyway, if you make this kind of small change of basic notation, so then your product of U1, U2 bar will look like, again, you assume that the correction terms go away, which in favor of condition can be arranged. So basically, if you choose your amplitudes right, so then U1, U2 bar will be, so here you have e to the minus tau x1 and e to the tau x1, so those will cancel, but then you will have e to the minus 2 I lambda x1 v1 x prime v2 x prime bar. Okay, so somehow by making this little modification, you have managed to get the nice family of oscillating function in x1 for free. So this is somehow, because x1 is just the usual Euclidean variable, you can use the Fourier transform in it. And then the idea is to choose your, somehow these amplitudes v1 v2 in the transversal manifold in such a way that the products will be dense there. So basically, you manage to make a reduction in dimension. For instance, if your original manifold is three-dimensional, then you only need to construct amplitudes in two dimensions. Okay, so what property should this V1 and V2 satisfy? So, because I'm working with this product metric, the Laplacian split into the d1 squared and the transversal Laplacian, so I have, for instance, so I want an exact solution u1 to the Schrödinger equation. This is the same as minus d1 squared. Okay, so u1 is equal to e to the minus sx1 v1 plus r1. And the idea again is you can somehow guess what the small v1 should look like, and then the r1 will be the thing which you get by solving an inhomogeneous equation. So I want to leave r1 on the other side and put all of the rest on the other side, and I'm going to make it symmetric by multiplying by an exponential, so this would be okay. So now this thing here will be, because the Laplacian is t1 squared minus Laplace t0, then this will be just minus Laplace d0 minus s squared plus capital V1 small v1 of x prime. Okay, So the idea, we want to choose small v1 so that this quantity does not grow in tau when tau goes to infinity. So let me spell that out. So want, for instance, minus Laplace t0 minus s squared plus v1 small v1 of x prime L2 of m norm is, let's say, small o of tau as tau goes to infinity. So if this is true, then I can use the Karlemann estimate or the solvability result for this inhomogeneous equation, which I gave you yesterday. And then you will gain 1 over tau in the R. So then the Karlemann estimate will give are one with the L2 norm R1 is small over one as tau goes to infinity. So really this error term will go away. Okay, so there's I mean this is already suggesting that V1 somehow should be a kind of an approximate eigenfunction with slightly complex frequency s. So let me make a definition. So we say that Vs of x prime, let's assume they are C2 functions in M0, where S is a slightly complex frequency, lambda is fixed, and tau is going to be large. So it's a family of functions in C2 where tau goes to infinity. It's a family of, so I'm going to use the word quasi-mode. So it means kind of an approximate eigenfunction. And okay, so quasi-mode, I guess, appears in a few different contexts, but I'm going to define a family of quasi-mode which is adapted to this particular situation. So if so it's going to satisfy minus Laplace G naught minus S squared of V S in L2 of M naught is small o one, and then the L2 norm of V S is small o big O one as tau goes to infinity when lambda is kept fixed. So you can see if these two conditions are satisfied, so then if since M is just a compact subregion in the cylinder, so then this condition will always be satisfied. It actually will be capital O1, which is better. So I could assume something. I could also put small o tau here, but it's probably not going to help. It would help if we are dealing with very irregular coefficients, but I'm not going to do that. Okay, so then I'm going to define another concept related to families of quasi-modes. So I measure mu lambda, which is in the set of bounded Borel measures in M0, is said to be a quantum limit of this family of quasi-modes. If so when you take the absolute value squared of V tau times the volume form on G naught is going to converge in the weak topology of measures to the measure mu lambda. Like this. And sorry? No, this is a limit on the Bayes manifold. I'll comment on that. So here it would be enough to just have a sequence of taus for which the weak limit exists. Okay, so and let me make a note with capital letters. So there's no boundary conditions required of of VS. So it's naturally, these things are defined on a manifold boundary, but there's no boundary conditions, so then they are not really eigenfunctions in that sense. So there's somehow more flexibility here. Okay, so before going into comparing what this definition, how this definition is related to the usual definition of a quasi-mode or a quantum limit, so let me tell you what you can do if you have a familiar quasi-mode so that it has a limit measure in this sense. Okay, so suppose VS is a familiar of this type, and I'm going to let U1 and U2 be the solution which I already defined, and I'm going to do it in such a way that U2 will be defined e to the SX1, and I'm going to take actually the same quasi-mode here as I have for U1. So it's clear that if VS is a quasi-mode for S, then it's also a quasi-mode for minus S, because if you change S by minus S, you are not changing anything here. So you obtain this RJ from the Karlmann estimate. And as I just argued, these conditions on the quasi-modes are going to ensure that the L2 norm of RJ will behave like 1 over tau, so it will really go away when tau goes to infinity. Okay, so then if you recall that, so when we are solving the inverse problem, so then we are often looking at the integral of the difference of potential against the product of two solutions, and now I'm going to take the solution U2 bar. So this will be, so now let's extend VJ by 0 into the cylinder. So then you can split the M integral into two parts. So there's integral minus infinity to infinity, integral over M naught. And you have V1 minus V2 of X1 X prime. And then you take the product of U1 U2 bar, so the tau, the exponential containing tau goes away, so then you will have just absolute value of VS X prime squared plus something which is small. Okay, so then, and this thing is if the Dirichlet Neumann maps are the same, this thing is equal to 0, and then you can take the limit when tau goes to infinity, and what you will have is switch the order of integration, so it will be integral over M naught, and then you have integral from minus infinity to infinity of this thing, which is just the Fourier transform of the difference of potentials in X1 evaluated at 2 lambda. So by this I mean the Fourier transform in the first component. And then, so you assume that you have a quantum limit, so you will have this measure here. So this thing vanishes for all possible quantum limits which you can construct on your transversal manifold M naught. And for any fixed lambda. Okay, so what this is showing that So this is showing that if you have a density result for the quantum limits, then you have solved your Calderon problem. So thus, if the set of possible quantum limits. Okay. Is dense in so the set of possible quantum limits mu lambda is dense, let's say, in the set of bounded measures on M naught, and if this can be done for many lambdas, so how many do you need? If you can do it for any lambda, then you have recovered the Fourier transform of V1 minus V2 in the X1 direction, and then you have recovered V1 minus V2. But actually, since if you go back to this picture, so V1 minus V2 is originally a function on your compact region M, and then you extend it by zero. So as a function of X1, it's actually compactly supported. So the Fourier transform is analytic, so it's enough to have this for some set of lambdas on the real line which have an accumulation point. That would also be enough. So then V1 is equal to V2. Okay. So this raises the question, for which transversal manifolds M naught G naught is the set of possible quantum limits dense? And let me tell you what I know about that question, or at least part of what I know. Okay, so but before going that, so let me. So I want to compare with what is known in general about these quantum limits or semi-classical limit measures. So this is really just related to the analysis of high-frequency eigenfunctions, which is a kind of a well-developed topic of interest in physics and in mathematics, and it's related very much to this quantum ergodicity business. So some general facts that are known are so here I have a manifold boundary, but the boundaries make life difficult, so let me just first tell you what is known when you don't have a boundary. On closed manifolds, so you would have something like this. Okay, so and let me first just talk about pure eigenfunctions, so not quasi-modes or approximate ones. So if phi k going from 1 to infinity is an orthonormal basis of L2 of M naught consisting of eigenfunctions, so then there exists a phase space semi-classical limit measure. So measure mu, which is a bounded Borel measure on the unit cosphere bundle of M naught, is a quantum limit of some subsequence phi kj if so you are looking at basically, you are evaluating 5kJs against some operator obtained by quantifying an order zero symbol. And I'm going to quantify it in a semi-classical way as where the small parameter is 1 over the square root of the corresponding eigenvalue. So this 1 over square root of lambda k j. So if this thing converges weakly, or actually, okay, I have pairing, so it converges in the usual sense to the integral over S star m a times d mu. And for all a, which are order zero pseudo differential symbols. Okay, so in this way you can sometimes associate to a subsequence of eigenfunctions, you can associate the measure on phase space to unit cost field bundle. And okay, so by some compactness arguments you know that there always exists at least one such limit measure for some subsequence. And this is really a measure on the phase space, and the measures which I'm considering here are the projections of, or they correspond to the projections of these phase space measures into the base manifold. And yeah, sorry? Yeah, that's the next comment. So so the reason why I'm using the base space measures here is because that seems to be what you get from the inverse form. So you get the integral of a function on x against basically the quasi-modes. Okay, so the next comment is actually what Gabriel was saying. So these things are invariant under geodesic flow. Okay, and this is somehow, you know, the guiding principle here is the quantum classical correspondence. The idea is if you have eigenfunctions, so they are kind of quantum objects, but if you look at them at very high frequencies, then you see some classical behavior, and the classical behavior will be related to the symbol of the Laplacian, which is the generator of geodesic flow. So this is basically a consequence of the Egorov theorem. And what kinds of measures? So you know that all quantum limits are invariant. So what more can you say? If the manifold has negative curvature, so then, as we've seen in Gabriel's lectures, then the geodesic flow is ergodic. So it's somehow uniformly distributed over the phase space, and then you expect a similar property for the quantum limit, and that's called quantum ergodicity. So there exists a density one subsequence phi kj whose quantum limit is the Liouville measure. Let me write it like this. So in Gabriel's notation this would be d sigma. So it really means that in negative curvature, because the geodesic flow becomes uniformly spread out, also the eigenfunctions will do it. And then there's the big open question of quantum unique ergodicity, which says, is this the only limit? And this only known in special cases. It's a big open question. Yeah. Yes. The work of Linda Strauss and this Soundarayan, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, so this is the context of Rudnik and Sarnak. Okay, so I mean, so this is kind of natural, but for us it would be very bad news because we want to prove that the quantum limits are dense. And if they are uniform spread out, so basically then you only have the constant function on the base manifold. So that would not be good. In some other situations, you can do better. So if the manifold happens to have a stable periodic geodesic in the inside, I'm not going to define stable at all here. In M naught, so then there exists a quantum limit supported on gamma. It's basically the delta function of the periodic geodesic. Okay, so these are some kind of general facts that are known. So in our case, it turns out that, as I said, we have more flexibility. Okay, so these facts are for a closed manifold, but you also have similar statements for manifolds with boundary when you, let's say, you impose Dirichlet boundary conditions on the eigenfunctions. But in our case, we don't really care what happens at the boundary. It could be anything. So there's more flexibility here. So it turns out that even in negative curvature, we do get the dense set of quantum limits. Okay. So let me go to somehow. Okay. So still, what this argument is telling you that so it gives you a fairly kind of general recipe for finding complex geometric optics solutions. So somehow, in order to have the correction terms going to zero, you need to have a limiting Karlmann weight. That's kind of the starting point of it all. So, and that kind of implies that you have to be in a cylinder. But if you accept that, so then you are in the cylinder. X1 is limiting Karlmann weight, and then the recipe for constructing complex geometric solutions is to choose your favorite quasi-mode constructions and try to see what kind of limit measure you get and try to show that they will be dense. So let me just start with some very simple examples of quasimodes. So in let's say you have a bounded domain in Rn and you want to look at some, you want to find some useful quasi-modes. So then you have the generalized eigenfunction. So you have e to the I s x dot omega. And let me further remind you, there's basically two differences between the quasi-modes which we are using in the inverse problem and the usual quasi-modes. So one thing is that we have a boundary, but we don't require any boundary conditions. And then the other thing is that we have a slightly complex eigenfrequency, which is going to affect the limit measures also. Okay. So anyway, so this is a pure eigenfunction. So if omega is direction in Rn, so you somehow think of it as something which is propagating in direction omega, and it's kind of oscillating in that direction. And but now, so for instance, if S is tau plus I lambda, for instance, if lambda is equal to zero, so then the absolute value of this is one, so it's not going to give you any interesting limit measure. But so you can easily modify this to become a quasi mode. So I'm going to let Vs of x to be equal to e to the is x dot omega b of x perp, where I understand that the x perp are the variables which are orthogonal to omega, and then b is going to be some kind of approximation of a delta function. So if you do this, then you want the quasi-mod, so you compute minus Laplace minus s squared of this, which will give you, so the derivatives in the omega direction will kill the s squared, so that's the eigenfunction part, and then you will have basically e to the is x dot omega, and then you have somehow the x perp directional Laplacian applied to B. And then if you take the absolute values of this and omega is bounded, so then this will be just essentially just so you take the absolute values, you have s is tau plus I lambda, so you have minus lambda x dot omega. So when omega is bounded, so this is always bounded independently of tau, if b is independent of tau, so you are good. So this is a quasi-mode, and then what's the limit measure? Vs of vs squared times dx is just, so you take absolute values here, the tau part goes away, and you only have the lambda, and then you have minus 2 lambda x dot omega b x perp squared dx. And since if b is independent of tau, so this is independent of tau, so this is the limit measure. So, sorry? Yeah. So the idea is that because you have a slightly complex frequency, you are going to get this attenuation factor. So really, somehow, when you are integrating along, so basically you want to concentrate near this quasi-mode near the line, and when you are integrating along the line, you are attenuating by this factor. So you come up with this attenuated rate transform, which Gabriel has been talking about. So that's really what happens. So the slightly complex frequency is going to give you an attenuation factor. Okay, so right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's go to a slightly more complicated situation. So now let M naught G naught be a simple manifold. So your M naught is something like this. And then you try to find quasi-modes by using the geometrical optics ansatz. So Vs is equal to e to the I. Now again you have the complex frequency is psi times the amplitude. and then you hit this thing with minus Laplace minus a squared, and then you see what you get. So you should get minus a squared, and this gives you the Iconal equation. For psi, and then you have probably have it somewhere here, yeah. And then you have the next term, which gives you a transport equation for A. Yeah, there is two here. And then you have the last term is just Laplacian. And the idea is you want the L2 norm of this to be independent, bounded independently of tau, so you choose this thing to be zero and this thing to be zero. So first you want to solve the Iconal equation. So how do you do this? So as I said a few lectures ago, this condition means that psi is a distance function in the manifold. So it's locally always given by the distance to some lower dimensional surface or the distance to a point. And now since you're on a simple manifold, you have actually nice global smooth distance functions. The idea is you extend your simple manifold to a slightly larger simple manifold, which you can do because the simplicity condition is stable. You pick a point outside of your original manifold, and since this manifold is simple, so the exponential map is going to give you a global system of coordinates. So you are going to basically, so if omega is a point in m naught hat minus m naught, and if r theta are polar Riemannian normal coordinates. In m naught hat with center omega. So r is the distance from the point, and theta is somehow the angle. And these are all radial geodesics starting from the point. So then psi of r of theta equals r is always a solution of the Iconal equation. So it's a global smooth solution in m naught. Okay, so in this way you can again so if your psi looks like this, so then your quasimod will be oscillating. Let's say you fix some geodesic gamma, then your quasimod will be oscillating along the geodesic, and then you multiply it by basically something which looks like a delta function concentrating near a fixed geodesic. So if B of theta looks like a delta function near a fixed geodesic gamma, it's a smooth function which approximates it. So then Vs will be e to the I. Sorry?
B is A.
B is A? No, B is the profile here. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So B will be part of A. Yeah, okay. It's not too difficult to check that in local coordinates, this function will be a quasimod with all the right properties, and then the limit measure will be Vs squared. And in this situation, you can let your approximate delta function depend on tau. When tau goes to infinity, it will become a delta function. So then your this thing will converge weakly into the measure e to the minus 2 lambda t delta function of the geodesic. So again, so the question was, are the quantum limits of these families of quasimodes dense? So then the question is, are these dense? And this is exactly the injectivity of the attenuated rate transform, which we know is true on simple manifolds. T is the, T is R. It's the evolution variable on the geodesic. So these are dense on simple manifolds by injectivity. Of the attenuated rate transform. It's a constant.
Okay.
It's a constant function on M. It says constant minus 2 lambda. Not that I know of. So in Gabriel's talk, the injectivity of this transform has been proved on simple two-dimensional manifolds. And if the dimension is 3 and higher, then it's not known if on a simple manifold of higher dimension if even the attenuated rate transform with constant attenuation would be injected. It's not known. At least not known to me. But the thing is, it's known for zero attenuation. And on simple manifolds, things are stable, so you can perturb your operator a little bit. So it's also known for small attenuations. And recall that I said that it's enough to have this density for a set of lambdas with an accumulation point. So you still are good even with knowing the injectivity for small lambda. So this actually somehow recovers the theorem from this paper with Dos Santos, Koenig, and Uhrman, which is saying that if Mg is embedded in a cylinder, and here you can have a conformal factor in the metric, and if additionally the transversal manifold M0 G0 is simple, so then you can the Dirichlet-Neumann map uniquely determines the potential. So it was, the proof was essentially the same which I just showed, but this somehow tiny change of point of view in basically going from, do I still have it here? Going from a real frequency tau into a slightly complex frequency, tau plus I lambda somehow, and makes it a bit more organized. Okay. No. Yeah, so the yeah, and the reason is because V1 minus V2 is compactly supported in the X1 variable, so the Fourier transform is analytic, so it's enough to know the Fourier transform for small. But for instance, let's say you would try to do a constructive version of this proof, then in the reconstruction you would only recover the Fourier transform V1 minus V2 for small frequencies. So you would need to do analytic continuation to get V1 minus V2. So for purposes like that, it would be good to have a injectivity result for all lambda. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the curvature. Okay, so, but this will be a Higgs field. Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, but I mean the thing is you are in dimensions 3 and higher, so the complex analysis is not there, at least in the same form. But still, if the attenuation is constant, maybe it would help. I don't know. Okay, so that's basically what has been known so far, and now the question is, can you do better? At the moment, it seems difficult to get rid of this product structure because that really is the starting point for all this. But this assumption here does not seem natural. Yeah, if you would have a dense set of distributions, then you would solve this question, for instance, for V1 and V2 in the test function space, which is also open. It doesn't help. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah. But I guess those are, I mean, is that the negative curvature phenomenon or? Okay. Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah. Okay, so finally, let me show what can be done if. So far, I only gave you two very simple quasi-mode constructions, and you can try to do something more sophisticated. So let me show what at least can be done. Okay, so now I'm going to assume the same conditions here, but I'm not going to assume that this thing is simple. So I want a quasi-mode construction for basically arbitrary manifold M dot G naught. So there can be conjugate points and all that. And so one natural thing to try would be just to look at the geodesic and see if you can find a quasi-mode which concentrates near a geodesic. So it can do some complicated things. It could even self-intersect, but that's for what I'm going to say. I'm going to assume that it doesn't self-intersect. But there can be conjugate points. Okay, so I'm going to let gamma be any geodesic in M naught G naught that somehow it comes in and after a finite time it goes out. So let's say gamma is from 0 t into m naught. So it comes in at time 0, goes out at time capital T, and then it stays inside for all intermediate times. And I'm also going to assume that it comes in non-tangentially and it exits non-tangentially. And again, for simplicity, it doesn't intersect itself. Okay, so can you find a quasi-mode which concentrates on the neighborhood of this geodesic? And the answer is you can. It somehow, if you look at what is known in the closed case, it's known that you cannot concentrate the quasi-modes near all geodesic just to satisfy some conditions. But actually in this case, when we have a boundary, but we are not asking for any boundary conditions, so then these restrictions go away, and you can do it, and you can even do it for a slightly complex frequency. Yeah.
So since you need the
Yeah, that's a good question. So if lambda is zero, then you can also do it in a closed geodesic. And I'm not quite sure what happens when you put the imaginary part of the frequency and you have a stable periodic one. But at least this thing you can do. And so this can be done. I mean, there's a number of approaches of how you might do this. So basically this, high frequency eigenfunctions are related to solutions of the wave equation. And there's a number of heuristic ways of seeing it. For instance, quasimodes are related to the resolvent of the Laplacian, and the resolvent can be expressed in terms of the wave propagators and vice versa. And high frequency eigenfunctions give you standing waves for the Schrödinger equation. So you might use some wave equation ideas to do that. And so for the wave equations, if you want to construct a solution which sticks close to fixed geodesic, you could just use theory of Fourier integral operators to which give you somehow relatively explicit solution operators to the wave equation, which somehow allow you to track where things go. Another approach is called Gaussian beams. So that's somehow, it's a much more explicit approach. It just allows you to write an ansatz for the solution and then solve some equations, and you get your solution which sticks close to a geodesic in a fairly explicit way. So I'm going to do the elliptic version of that. So I'm going to construct a Gaussian beam quasi-mode. Or at least that's the name which we are using for it at the moment. I don't know if there's a better one. Yeah. Since, of course, I don't have so much time, so I'll have to be very sketchy here. So I have this fixed geodesic, and let's assume, so this is time zero, this is time capital T, and you extend it a little bit to time minus epsilon and T plus epsilon. So you can always do that. And so I'm going to do this construction, so it will be convenient to use a special system of coordinates on the geodesic, and the canonical choice is the Fermi normal coordinates on the geodesic. So I'm going to let Ty be Fermi coordinates. Near capital gamma, which is the image of the geodesic. So what this means is that the geodesic is given by the set T0. So somehow T is the variable of evolution along the geodesic, and Y is the somehow orthogonal to the geodesic. And then also if you look at the metric in Fermi coordinates on the geodesic, so then, well, let me put up our JK since that's the only thing I'm going to use. So on the geodesic, the metric is the identity, and then the first order derivatives of the metric on the geodesic vanish. So you can always, even if you have a long geodesic which does not self-intersect, you have these coordinates in a full tubular neighborhood of the geodesic. And even if it self-intersects, then you can just take finitely many of these things somehow. When you hit an intersection point, then you somehow stop, and then you continue the coordinates through somehow infinitely many pieces. Um, so we construct VS, which is quasi mode, and VS concentrate near capital gamma, and then we are going to use, as I said, you have an explicit ansatz for doing it. So VS of TY, I'm going to look for it in the form e to the IS. There's a complex phase function theta of TY, and then there's amplitude ATY. And somehow, the idea is that somehow your phase function, I mean, the first idea is that it should be solving some kind of iconal equations, but this geodesic might have lots of conjugate points, so you don't have global solutions of the iconal equation. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let this theta be complex, and it's going to have somehow a positive imaginary part. And I'm only going to solve these equations not in a full neighborhood of the geodesic, but I'm only going to solve them to high order on the geodesic. And it turns out that this thing will have a Gaussian profile orthogonal to the geodesic. So it will actually be a Gaussian function in the transversal, in the y coordinates, and that will keep it very close to the geodesic. So solve. We're going to solve equations for theta and a to high order on the geodesic instead of solving them in a full neighborhood of it. Well, I'm going to show you, I'm going to show you a way in which you can ensure that they will be smooth all the way, somehow. It's not exactly an iconal equation. It will be a Riccati equation, but you'll see. Right. So it's kind of, Yeah, somehow the problem comes when you take the Laplacian of your psi, so it could be very bad. Yeah, but that's true. Psi will be Lipschitz, but the Laplacian of psi could be very bad. Okay, so I want to compute minus Laplace G naught minus S squared of my ansatz, and this will be e to the IS theta, and then you have minus S squared, and then you have what do you have? d theta minus 1 plus something times S plus something. I'm only going to concentrate on the top order equation. And okay, this will have an A also. So you solve this kind of complex iconal equation. So theta is a complex function to high order on the geodesic. Okay, so now I have my Fermi coordinates. I'm going to solve this equation in Fermi coordinates. So I'm going to write theta as a polynomial in terms of y, so I'm essentially going to make a Taylor expansion in the y direction, in the direction orthogonal to the geodesic, where theta j of t y will be sum alpha equals j theta j alpha of t alpha factorial y to the alpha. And also write my metric g upper jk as sum j going from 0 to n. Okay, I need to use an L. G upper jk L plus some remainder, where this GL is a polynomial of order L in Y. Okay, so this is the Taylor series of the metric in the orthogonal Y direction. And so what Fermi coordinates by us is G upper JK 0 is just the identity matrix, and G upper JK 1, which is the first order term in the Taylor series of the metric, is 0. Okay, so somehow in Fermi coordinates, if you look at the geodesic local, it's somehow flat up to order one. So in the flat case, you would take theta of t just equal to t. But our geodesic is only flat up the first order, so I'm only going to take the zero part to be equal to t, and then theta 1, which is the first order polynomial in y, is going to be 0. And then the first, somehow the really non-trivial part, will be the theta 2, and I'm going to write theta 2 of ty, so this is a second order polynomial in y, so I'm going to write it in terms of a matrix h of t y dot y, where h of t is a complex symmetric I guess. Okay, so if the dimension of m naught equals m, so then this will be m by m matrix. That's right. Okay. Yeah, because the evolution variable is out. Okay. So then I just need to write down this equation, and I'm going to write this in somehow grouping the right like powers of y, and then solving somehow successively. So then g upper jk dj theta dk theta minus 1. So this is the quantity which you want to be equal to 0. Is equal to. So now I'm. Okay, so let t be. Okay, I'm getting some trouble with my labeling. So y is. Okay. I hope you understand my. Okay, so. Okay, so this should be fine. So t is. Okay. So x are the coordinates in M naught, so t is the first coordinate, and the y are the rest of the coordinates. I'm sorry, it's a bit confusing. And then somehow I want to separate the parts which here depend on t, so I have d11, d15, which is just the t derivative, and d15, which is again just the t derivative. So this will be g upper 11 will be 1 plus g upper 11 second order in y plus high order in y, and then dt of phi will be dt of theta will be, you just have t, so you have 1, and then this will give you 0, and then you have dt theta 2, and then you have another dt theta. So this is, I'm just writing the different powers of y, and I'm using the fact that dt of theta naught is 1. Okay, and then I have the some mixed terms, so you have some further confusing notation. So alpha and beta will be going from 2 to m, so these will be corresponding to y variables. So you have g 1 alpha, and the metric is identity of the first order, so you will only have g 1 alpha 2. So it starts at the second order in y, and then you will have dt, which is the same as I just had, and you get this twice. So what am I doing? So this is the g, and this is the dt of theta, and then I want d alpha of theta, which will be 0 and 0 and d alpha of theta 2. Nothing where?
The one was in the same place.
This is tricky to get it right on the blackboard. Okay, and then you have the d alpha beta, d alpha theta, d alpha, d beta theta, which will give you delta alpha beta. The first order part is 0, and then you will have g alpha beta, second order in y, and then you have d alpha of theta, which will be just d alpha of theta 2 plus higher order in y, d beta of theta 2 plus higher order in y, and then you still have the minus 1. Okay, so what is the top order term? This 1 will give you 1, and it will be cancelled here. So the top order term actually comes, it will be the second order polynomial in y. So you just collect the second order parts, which will be, you will get 1 dt theta 2 1, and you get another one from here. And what else is second order? From here you get, this thing is always at least of order 2, and this is of order 0, this of order 1, so this is at least of order 3, so it doesn't matter. And then you have this, which will give you and then you still have the d211111. Plus order of y to the third. So you identify the top order term. And this you want to be equal to 0. And this actually, when you write your theta 2 in terms of the H matrix, will be H derivative of T plus, and this will give you HT of Y dot HT of Y, and you put H on the other side, use the fact that it's symmetric. So you get H squared. And then this stuff here is it's second order derivatives of the metric, so it's a curvature. So it will be okay, this part I'm not going to get right. If you are in two dimension, it's the Gaussian curvature. Yeah, it is. But now I'm going to assume m is equal to 2, because I won't be able to get it right otherwise. Sorry? Yeah, right, okay. So that's the, okay, so you probably cannot see it. No, you can. That's the equation which you need to manage to get to zero. So that thing is matrix Rikert equation. And actually, if m is equal to 2, if m not is two dimensions, it's just a scalar equation. Plus the curvature, and you're saying that this would be R of... Okay. Yeah, I believe you, so... Yeah. Okay, so we saw this in... Sorry? Yeah, okay, so... So I'll just be very brief in explaining how we do this. So we saw this equation yesterday with Gabriel, and we saw that when you have no conjugate points, then let's say you solve it in such a way that you start h of t from zero here, and if this geodesic has no conjugate points, then this... then you will have a global solution. So basically you will look for a solution as b prime of t over b of t. So now I'm again going to the scalar case. And if there's no conjugate points, then b will never be zero if you start from zero, so this will be a nice smooth thing. So what happens when you have a conjugate point somewhere? So your denominator might become zero, so you don't have a smooth solution. And somehow the trick here is to use a complex solution. So I'm going to assume that imaginary part of h of 0 is positive. And so it turns out that so I think what it will be is, so what is imaginary part of h of t will be b prime over b, let's see, this would be 2i minus b prime bar over b bar, so this will be b prime b bar minus b prime bar b over b squared, and this is 1 over b squared and the imaginary part of b bar of t, b prime of t. So it turns out that that this thing, so if you write h of t like this, so then your b, again, if you go to the two-dimensional case when you just have a scalar equation, will be a solution of the kind of corresponding Jacobi equation, where the curvature is just the curvature along your geodesic. And so then it turns out that this thing will be a constant in t if this thing is satisfied. I mean, you just compute the t derivative of this and use the fact that k is real valued, and that gives you somehow. So what this is saying, that the imaginary part of h of t is, if you start from something zero, then it's always going to be positive. And this 2i probably should not be here, but I don't know. somehow adding a little bit of imagery part here allows your solution of the Riccati equation survive through the conjugate point and stay smooth. And so in this way you get your somehow the top order term in the theta function, and then you just go to the high order term, solve linear ODEs, so only the first one will be non-linear, and the rest of them will always be linear ODEs, and then you get your VS equals e to the IS theta A, where actually if you look at VS squared, so this will look something like e to the minus 2 lambda t, and then there will be kind of a e to the minus tau imaginary part of h of t y dot y, and then there's some stuff which is better, and then there's a squared. So somehow this is the attenuation factor, and this part makes your Quasimodo look like a Gaussian along the geodesic. When tau goes to infinity, you can take the limit, and the quantum limit will be e to the minus 2 lambda t delta gamma of t. So you recover the delta function, the attenuated delta function of the geodesic also when you have conjugate points. And I'll end this course with a conjecture that these things are dense whenever your manifold is non-trapping. And this would solve also the Calderon problem in the case of non-trapping transversal manifold. And I encourage people to think about this question, even though it might not be easy. Okay, thanks. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and also this, I mean, this idea that you have a boundary and your Quasimodo could look like anything outside, because in the end you're only going to have an integral over this compact set. So it's somehow, there's no boundary conditions, there's no conditions imposed by the being on a closed manifold and having to have a global thing, so. Yeah.